Hello and welcome to the Microbiome Medics podcast. I'm Dr. Siobhan McCormack.
And I'm Dr. Sheena Fraser, and we're your co-hosts.
We are both GPs and lifestyle medics with a shared passion for microbiome science, and we have spent the last 5 years deep diving into the world of the gut microbiome.
We've been analysing the evidence, appraising the studies, speaking to the experts, and writing the Gut Microbiome for Clinicians e-learning course for the BSLM Learning Academy.
We have discovered that the gut and other human microbiomes are pivotal to every aspect of your health and physiology, and the pillars of lifestyle medicine hold the key.
So in these Microbiome Medic podcasts, we'll be covering the basics, bringing you the latest research and talking to the experts on all matters microbiome.
We'll be translating the evidence and packaging it into actionable, bite-sized chunks so that you can harness the power of the microbiome to improve your own health and that of your patients.
Welcome to the Microbiome Medic's first ever podcast. This podcast is all about what are microbiomes and why should you care about them? In this podcast today, Siobhan and I are going to take you through why we got interested in microbiome science, what microbiome science has done to our own clinical practice, how we've changed as a result of our knowledge of microbiome science. And then we're going to take you through some listener questions and on to some latest news and research in the field of microbiome science. And then, you know, follow up with some ideas about future podcasts. So that's us. We're going to start here. So Siobhan, can you tell me a little bit more about you and why you got into microbiome science?
I can. Hi, Sheena. Hi, everyone. So I'm Dr. Siobhan McCormack, and I'm a GP. I qualified years ago in the early 1990s. So I've been a GP partner for over 30 years, and I've really loved it. But really, over the last 5, maybe 10 years, I've become increasingly uncomfortable, really, about the kind of tsunami of chronic disease and the sheer loss of years of healthy life, the suffering of patients, and the numbers of medications I'm prescribing, the poor compliance that, you know, we know that patients, a lot of them don't take these medications, and also concerns about side effects and all the concerns about things like opioids and side effects from other medications as well. And I began to think that beneficial behaviours and lifestyle medicine pillars were really overlooked or minimised or ignored. And my colleagues seemed to think that patients would never follow them, so there's no point in telling them about diet or sleep or exercise. And we moved quicker and quicker onto drugs and procedures, really. And I felt that these sort of behaviours were seen as weak or ineffective compared to the presumed power of drugs and procedures. So I started looking at the evidence to explore solutions outside medicines and medications, really. And I was blown away. You've got to remember that I qualified in 1989, and there was nothing in my medical curriculum that talked about these lifestyle medicine pillars. And the research over the last 20 or 30 years has been incredible. The molecular biology of sleep, physical activity, stress, nutrition, the sheer volume and detail from these incredible sources and educational institutions and organizations globally, really. I started looking, and then I happened to cross the BSLM, and I spoke to Dr. Rob Law, who, as you know, is the BSLM co-founder, or was, and previous president, and just really enjoyed his enthusiasm and talking about all the benefits of all these lifestyle medicine pillars for preventing, managing, and even reversing many chronic diseases. And the BSLM had them all in one place, so I was hooked. So I joined that day, and I studied for the BSLM diploma and got that in 2018, and I've not really looked back. So that's my lifestyle medicine sort of bio. So what about you, Sheena?
Okay, Siobhan. Well, that's your lifestyle medicine bio. How about how you got into microbiome science?
So that was around the same time. I suppose I only found out I had microbiomes really in 2018, when I was sort of reading about these crazy guys in Cork, John Cryan, who's a neuroscientist, and there was Ted Dinnan, who's a psychiatrist, And they were sort of doing amazing research about the gut microbiome and the microbiota in the gut communicating, chatting to the brain. And there was this bi-directional communication, and that this impacted mood, behavior, and other neuropsychiatric diseases. So I think everyone thought they were crazy, but they wrote this incredible book, The Psychobiotic Revolution, which was kind of, I think it was, there was a journalist who co-wrote it with them called Scott Anderson. And it was remarkable that basically I found out I had an ecosystem in my gut, an Amazonian rainforest of trillions of microbes that were communicating with my brain and with all my other organs in this bi-directional manner, and that everything I ate and, you know, all the lifestyle medicine pillars really were hugely important to the gut microbiome. So I was completely hooked, read loads about it, read all the, well, not all the research papers because there's too many of them, but a lot of them, and started following some of the key sort of organizations globally. And then oddly, around that time, the BSLM, Ellen Fallows asked if anyone was interested in doing a course. So I stuck my hand up, and Sheena, you stuck your hand up too.
That's right.
And that's when we started working together. So yeah, what about you?
So yeah, a similar journey to you in that sort of felt that there was something missing in my clinical practice. And I happened upon the Lifestyle Medicine Conference in 2018. And I sat in this conference with all these incredible like-minded doctors and suddenly felt that I'd found my home. And it was in this conference that I had a lecture from a guy called Professor Robert Thomas, a professor in oncology down in, I think, Cambridge. And he did this incredible lecture on the microbiome. And I'd never heard of it. And I thought, how did I never hear about this really important aspect of us that just seemed absolutely incredible? And it was really my mission from then on to find out more. So I did the diploma in lifestyle medicine like you. And at the same time, I was sort of frantically reading everything I could on the microbiome. And you know, we joined up together. We joined forces about 3-4 years ago. And we've both been madly researching it ever since. So yes, it's become a big part of our daily lives, hasn't it? So I guess, Siobhan, what we need to do next is really talk about what microbiome science is and really why it's important. So we should probably start off with some facts. Do you want to just give a basic rundown on, we'll talk about the gut microbiome and what that means?
Yeah, so the course that we co-wrote is the gut microbiome for clinicians. And the reason why it's the gut microbiome and not all the other microbiomes is that's the one that's most researched. It's the largest and most diverse. But we sort of envisage with this podcast that we will be looking at other microbiomes as time passes. But we've got to remember, Sheena, that we've been looking at this for several years now. And it's, on one level, it sounds really simple because you just think, okay, you've got these microbes in your gut. That's all very interesting. But then once you start looking into it, it can get very complex very quickly. So I'm just going to start with some really simple facts, some real basics. So if I just take, I don't know, six facts, let's just do that so that I don't confuse everyone. So first of all, microbiomes, what are they? They're collections of microbes. So that's just another term for microorganisms in a specified location. So humans, for example, have many microbiomes. We have microbiomes on our skin, in our mouth, in our gut. And even within each of those areas, for example, the skin, there's lots of different tribes and subcommunities. So the skin under your armpit will be different from the skin behind your right ear. So you have these ecosystems which differ even on the skin. So we are mostly microbial. So in terms of cell count, we're a little over 50% microbial compared to the number of human cells, which is pretty incredible. But when you then look at our gene count, because the human genome is about 20,000, actually we're over 99% genetically microbial. And I just think that is astonishing. And I suppose that was what I want people to understand, is that we're we're no longer we can't see ourselves as Homo sapiens anymore. We're these holobionts, which are part microbial and part human. So as I've said, most of these microbes live in your gut, particularly in the large intestine, the colon, and most of the microorganisms are bacteria. So there are other things like fungi and archaea and viruses, which we will be talking about as well. But most of the research is really focused on the colon and on bacteria. And there's over 100 trillion microorganisms in the colon alone and over 10,000 different species. So it's an incredibly complex metropolis, this ecosystem that you have this in your gut. I see it as this kind of Amazonian rainforest. And also, every person's gut microbiome is unique to them. So Sheena's will be different to mine. And it's almost like a fingerprint. So I think that's about six facts. That'll do for now. So over to you, Sheena.
Yeah, so the other important thing is to realise about microbiome science is it's really just taken off since about the 1970s. And the reason why microbiome science took off then is because we changed the way we could actually analyse these communities. So prior to that, we would look down microscopes and we would look at single communities of bacteria in isolation, and we would look at how they behaved in isolation. But we could never really study them as a whole community, like, and see how they interacted with other bacteria, other organisms, and see how they functioned. So it was in the 1970s that gene sequencing allowed us to actually, you know, take that whole microbial community and look at them as a whole. And so that's, you know, massively changed the science and made us sort of realize that they function very, very differently when they're together. So the bacteria, you know, will function differently depending on the size of their population, but also depending on the other populations of microbes that they are close to and that are interacting with them. So it's really, really fascinating how we now study these microorganisms. And we've obviously discovered that they have massive functions, you know, that we had no idea that they were responsible for. So you know, they have a huge influence on our health, which is why, as a doctor, I'm so fascinated by them. It really explains an awful lot about the way we function and the way we create disease in our bodies when we understand the microbial populations and how they interact with us. So that's really another reason why it's so important to us. Shiv, are you going to tell us where our gut microbiome comes from?
Yeah, so I'm going to focus on this huge window of opportunity at birth. So if we focus on the actual birth and birth canal, this is hugely important in the genesis of your gut microbiome. So the mode of delivery, so a normal delivery, a vaginal delivery, the maternal perineum allows the baby to be exposed to microorganisms from mum's vagina, mum's gut and mum's skin. So particularly her gut microbiome is meant to be very important because these bacteria and other microorganisms that are in the perineal area actually get transferred to the baby, the neonate as it's born, goes through the mouth and down to the gut and also on the baby's skin as well. And these bacterial pioneers are hugely important because they are the first pioneers to enter the baby's gut, and they're the sort of really, really important to the genesis of the gut microbiome. And the other really important thing is the mode of infant feeding. So breast milk contains not only live bacteria, but also incredibly, mum makes food not for her baby, but for her baby's microbes, for these pioneers that she sent off with her child. And this food that mum makes, these HMOs, the human milk oligosaccharides. So they're sort of carbohydrate sugar units that can only be digested by the bacteria in her baby's gut. And I think that's astonishing because they found out there's over 200 of these HMOs. So mum spends a lot of time and energy making these HMOs, not for her baby, but for her baby's bacteria. And it's really important because if we miss these steps, so instead of having a normal vaginal delivery, there's a huge increase in the number of cesarean sections. And obviously, they're incredibly important and life-saving if used appropriately. But there is a concern that they're, rising at an exponential rate. So cesarean sections, you miss out on this contact with the perineal microbes. And, that has consequences. And also breastfeeding, particularly the UK, we're a very low breastfeeding nation. Well, I think we're the lowest globally for all sorts of reasons that I won't go into. And again, this isn't blame for mothers or parents. It's, it's the society which we live in, and that's where we take our cues from. But it's really important that we understand that the neonate is missing out on these vital microbes, a very important part of their life, because if they do get these good microbes in the gut and placed in there at an early stage, it's hugely important for their health trajectory going forward and for the development, particularly of their immune system, and for lots of other parts of their health and physiology, which we'll be talking about in further podcasts. So, Sheena, those are my two factors. What do you want to add to that?
Well, I guess, the other important aspect of microbiome science that I kind of touched on was the fact that it's so related to our health. And I guess the health of our gut microbiota or gut microbiome is not a given. And sadly, as Siobhan, you've already said, if you are born by vaginal delivery and you're breastfed, then you've got a great start in life. But if you're born by a C-section, if you have a load of antibiotics when you're first born, or if you're bottle fed, then that will impact on the health of your gut microbiome and the development of it. And that health of the gut microbiota, so the type of microorganisms that are present in our gut, will actually influence how our immune system develops in the gut. Because a huge quantity of our immune system is actually stored in our gut. And the gut microbiota and the bacteria there seem to train our immune system. So it seems to be quite important early on to have that training. So the first thing that really matters with the health of our gut microbiota is our start in life. Thereafter, once we get to sort of age 3 onwards, it becomes a little bit more adult-like, the gut microbiota that we have. And so there's a whole manner of things that will influence the health of the microorganisms that are there. The first one, obviously, is diet. And obviously, if we have a very healthy diet full of fruits and vegetables and a big variety of plants and keep away from too much sugar and fat and Western foods, then we'll encourage all the right organisms into our gut and we'll encourage a nice variety of beneficial microorganisms in there. Whereas if we have a very unhealthy diet, that will definitely harm the microbiome populations of our gut, and we'll have more of the harmful organisms in our gut, and that will have an impact on our health. It's worth sort of stating that other things are really important as well. So our exposure to nature, people growing up in more rural communities have healthier gut microbiomes than those growing up in an urban development. Our exposure to pets matters, and dogs and cats can be very beneficial for our microbiome. Birds can be less so. They can carry microorganisms that are more harmful to us. The sterility of our environment, so how much cleaning we do in our environment will impact the health of our gut microbiota. And our exposure to chemicals and pollutants and things like that will all impact. Our levels of stress, our quantity of sleep that we get and the amount of exercise we do also has an impact on our gut microbiota. So there's lots of different things that will input into the health of our gut microbiome. And as we said before, lifestyle medicine and microbiome science are very closely intertwined because of this. So that's really, massively important. As GPs, we need to know all of this, and we need to know that this can influence the health of your gut and overall your overall health going forward. So with that in mind, we were thinking of talking about really how microbiome science and how this knowledge has affected the way we practice So Shiv, would you like to start off and just mention a couple of ways that you think your clinical practice has changed now that you have all of this additional knowledge on microbiome science?
Yeah, thanks, Sheena. I think when we decided to put this bid in, we both felt it was really important to get very practical straight away, because there's all this incredible research being done at all these global institutions and universities all over the world. But it all looks very complex when you read it. And often you kind of think, well, how can I translate that? We have to wait for the results of more research, if it's probiotics or, you know, other interventions that they might be using. But it's really important that we understand that the microbiome isn't something that we're waiting to be invented. It's something that's here already. It's within us. It predates Homo sapiens. It's kind of, you know, our ancient inheritance. And it's already hugely important for our biology and physiology and health. And the wonderful thing about lifestyle medicine practices is that they're beneficial in so many ways. And it's, as Sheena was saying, all the pillars of lifestyle medicine are the same pillars that our gut microbiome would choose and favour and would keep them in sort of in health. So we wanted people to sort of understand that you can apply this straight away to, we're both general practitioners, but, you know, whether you're healthcare assistants or physiotherapists or osteopaths, you know, you can apply this straight away. I would say the most important thing for me in my general practice talking to patients is the narrative. Patients love the gut microbiome narrative. They've read about it and they've heard about it they've heard about it on radio, read about it in magazines, and a lot of them just haven't heard their GPs talking about it. So they rarely hear about it in hospitals or in an NHS setting, but they really understand the ecology. They understand the idea of looking after your gut microbiome and feeding it the right things and, you know, making sure that you get sufficient rest and reduce your stress. So I sort of think they'll actually do things for their gut microbiomes that they wouldn't do for themselves, oddly, and they kind of make sense to them and they have a reason to do it. And often it makes sense of their biology, and it's just a really fascinating story to tell. And also it explains to them how important it is that they eat plenty of fiber, and, you know, we get into conversations about yogurt and prebiotics and, you know, how they can look after their gut. And if you look after your gut microbiome, it's actually another narrative, another way of saying this is how you look after yourself. But somehow it's taken on board more easily. The other thing is, I would say, I think it's a time saver because they take the narrative on so easily. So there was one lady who's about 60 with fatty liver and resistant hypertension. And I was spending, you know, month after month, she was coming back to me and really finding it difficult to find the motivation to change. We started talking about other things, and actually we discussed she was a gardener and she was passionate about roses. And so she had actually a real passion and connection to soil and plants and ecosystems. And then we started talking about the gut microbiome, and she really took to this ecosystem idea and the idea of tending to her gut garden, and it made a huge difference in her mindset. And she made, you know, much better progress after that in her health journey by focusing on feeding her microbes. It's the focus is on nourishing and feeding, not, you know, taking things away and not having this and not having that. I really like this idea that we should be nourishing our bodies, not stopping eating, you know, lots of things. It should be about, you know, how do we make our biological system work best? So she was one real success story on a gut microbiome, from a gut microbiome aspect. She lost weight, her BP is well controlled. She's reduced a couple of her medications. She wants to get off the final one. And she's very empowered and confident about her body and her ability to change it. And she's, you know, gone off reading. She's probably read loads more than me now. She's reading lots of books, and she's really enjoying it. So that's what I think as a narrative and as a time saver. So what about you, Sheena?
Yeah, so I mean, that definitely rings bells with me as well, Siobhan. In clinical practice, people are not threatened by talks about the microbiome. And in fact, you know, it's a lovely conversation to have, especially with somebody, for example, with obesity, when you're trying to get them to lose weight. Instead of a discussion about what they can't eat, you're having discussions about what they need to increase in their diet, you know, having more fruits and vegetables and seeds and nuts and whole grains and fermented foods. And suddenly it opens up all this exciting world of food to people that, you know, have previously been on very drab, boring diets. And you know, it's a way of them to start taking a real interest in food again. And I've certainly had great success with people who want to lose weight for various reasons, and, you know, getting them to do so with a very sort of microbiome friendly diet, which essentially is like the Mediterranean diet. In clinical practice. So, you know, we all know what that is, but it's, you know, it just contains a wide variety of fruits and vegetables and seeds and nuts and all these plants, with much fewer processed foods and things in their diet. So, you know, it's a nice conversation to have. And, you know, I use that every day. For me, you know, I used to ask people, well, where does autoimmune disease come from? Well, you know, how does that happen? You know, tell me why somebody gets this. And nobody could ever really tell me. And it used to really wind me up that we didn't know the origin of disease. And I think we're much closer to understanding that now with microbiome science, because suddenly you can see the factors that all fall into place to sort of trigger autoimmune conditions. And, you know, leaky gut and this disharmony of the gut, this dysbiosis of the gut microbiome, plays a large role in chronic disease and autoimmune conditions and allergies. And so we're now putting the pieces together, and suddenly, you know, medicine seems to make a lot more sense for me. And so, you know, that's a good conversation to be having with people as well. So, you know, when they come in with their chronic diseases, I can say, well, you know, what went wrong in your life for you to develop this? You know, what happened to you? And, you know, we can look back and we can see whether it was, you know, periods of sleep deprivation, you know, bad diets, too much stress in their lives. And, you know, looking at all of these factors and trying to bring them all back into line. And, you know, it's much more positive to have these conversations about changing lifestyle and preventative medicine, rather than saying, well, you know, here's your drugs for your hypertension, just take this forevermore. I'm saying to people, well, okay, I'm going to have to treat your hypertension, but now let's get to the bottom of why you got that in the first place, and let's try and fix what went wrong so that we can bring you off these medications. And so, you know, for me, it's a very different conversation these days with my patients, and I like it because I'm trying to fix people and I'm trying to prevent disease, and I'm trying to stop them coming back in years to come with another disease. So for me, it makes a lot more sense. And that's really, you know, where I've ended up with microbiome science. And I think, you know, if you were to take an interest in this, doing our course will give you a lot more ammunition to be able to use more of this in clinical practice. So that's where we're at. Now, what we were going to move on to, Siobhan, was just a few questions that we got from some of our colleagues on microbiome. So there's a few things that I think confuse people over microbiome science. For a start, we got a question from Alex, the president of BSLM, because he finds that people are often confused between what is a microbiome and what is a microbiota. So I was just wondering, Siobhan, if you could tell us what the difference between microbiome and microbiota are.
Yeah, I'll take that one. So the microbiome, oh, we start with the microbiota. The microbiota are the microorganisms themselves. So that's the living microbes. So, for example, the bacteria, the fungi, the archaea, and usually we talk about them in one place. So the gut microbiota would be those microorganisms in the gut. Now, the gut microbiome is the microbiota plus their biome. Now, the biome is the home, the habitat. So it's based on ecological terminology and not genome, as everyone, as quite often people mistakenly think. So it's actually the habitat, so the structures, the proteins, the gut cells, all the surrounding structures. Now, quite a good way of thinking of this, I sort of tell people, imagine your local hospital. If you imagine the doctors, the nurses, the physiotherapists, the caterers, the ODAs, the cleaners, all of them are akin to the microbiota. However, the microbiome equivalent would be all of the staff plus the hospital, the rooms, the beds, the catering equipment, the ECG machines, you know, the whole lot, all the computer systems, everything. So that is the equivalent of the microbiome. So hopefully that'll stick in your head.
Brilliant. Thanks for that. Right, we've got one more question, and that is, what is a probiotic? I'll explain this one. Basically, probiotics are beneficial bacteria that confer a health benefit on the host. So there's a whole number of microorganisms that we've isolated from the gut and from other parts of the body that we've shown do lots of beneficial things for us, like help us to produce hormones and vitamins and help us to produce metabolic byproducts that improve our immune system and help us fight disease and help us prevent cancers. So basically, if this bacteria has been shown in clinical trials to be beneficial to us, then it's termed probiotic. So you will see probiotics for sale in health food shops. And these are microorganisms that they have basically isolated and put together into some formulation that you can have as a supplement. In addition, you'll get probiotics within some fermented foods. And in fermented foods like yogurts, for example, some yogurts will term themselves probiotic whilst others will not. Now, that basically means that the ones that are saying that they're probiotic have some form of evidence base to back them up, that those are beneficial microorganisms. However, that's not to say that the yogurts that don't say they're probiotic are not beneficial to you. It's just that they don't then have the evidence base to back them up. However, a standard, very basic yogurt will contain about 4 strains of very beneficial microorganisms that we know, they'll generally be lactobacilli and bifidobacteria, and they're very, very beneficial to our health. So even if they have not termed themselves probiotic, I would still say there is just as much benefit to them as there is to the ones that are terming themselves probiotic. So beware of a lot of good marketing skills there on parts of these companies. The likes of Actimel, for example, they don't have huge quantities of microorganisms in them. And they may only have 1 or 2 microorganisms in their products, whereas a standard, very basic, plain yogurt that's unsweetened will probably have about 3 or 4 strains of bacteria and the quite high quantities of them. Because so long as you sweeten your product, that will knock out a lot of the bacterial population. So the less sweet your yogurt, the more bacteria will be in there.
So Sheena, I think it's quite a complex and interesting area. So I think we should have a whole podcast on probiotics because it's really interesting and it's one of those things which everyone seems to find confusing.
Definitely.
Yeah. So what we're going to do now is we thought it would be good if we had a section on the research. So this is going to change with each podcast. So it might be some really key historical landmark papers that are very important in microbiome science research, or some very up to the minute new bit of research that's just hot off the press. So this time, Sheena, you sounded impressed by one of these very hot off the press papers that I think you only heard about last week. Do you want to tell us about that? And then we'll have a chat about it.
Sure, Shiv. So this is a good one. Actually, I have to thank my dad for this because we share papers, me and my dad and my mum as well. They're both scientists, my parents, and my dad has a bit of an interest in neuroscience, being an ex-marine neuroscientist. So basically, he sent me this paper, which takes a slightly different look at pain and the reasons why we have pain. So it was really, really fascinating. So this is a paper that was produced in Cell in October 2022. So it's a very new piece of research. And it was produced by Yang et al. And it was called Nociceptor Neurons Direct Goblet Cells via a CGRP RAMP1 axis to drive mucus production and gut barrier protection.
Sheena, I'm going to have to stop you there. Okay, that is very, very complex. I don't know what most of those words mean.
Yeah,
but
no,
what are you
neither.
Doing to us?
Me neither.
Okay. You need to make this simple. I'm just not going to be able to cope.
Basically, if we get inflammation or pain, then we have these cells, these nociceptor cells, these pain cells that basically fire off, and they're basically detecting harmful stimuli, and then they're firing off to mediate our pain and our avoidance behaviors. So we know that when we get a pain, we generally avoid that area, or we know that it's something that we've got to take note of if we have a pain. And up until now, we've always thought that that was just a way of signaling to us to avoid certain behaviors and things. But we hadn't really thought too much about the other functions of pain. Obviously, pain attracts inflammatory cells to the area to help to heal. So it is involved in other things as well. But this paper adds something else to it. Okay, so what they actually found in this, and it was an animal study, it was mouse studies that they used in this paper, but they found that the pain receptors actually produce compounds that will directly communicate with goblet cells in the gut. Now, goblet cells are these cells that line the gut that create mucus. And mucus is one of the most important things in our gut microbiome to protect the gut wall. And the gut wall is fundamental to the health of the gut microbiome. So if we have a really strong gut wall with loads of gut mucus, then generally the species of bacteria that reside within the gut microbiome are more protected and healthier. The mucus is used by colonocytes as a type of food. So it helps to keep them healthy, but also it protects the wall from the wall getting damaged and holy. And so it prevents this thing called leaky gut. So this is interesting because what it suggests is that if you have a pain, then the pain itself is triggering a thickening of the mucus layer in the gut. And why would that be important? Well, you know, if we have a pain, then it seems that we're sort of bolstering the thickness of the gut to protect our gut microbiome and to enhance our immune response, because a lot of the microbial cells in the gut play a very important role in the immune system. So this is interesting. We didn't really realize the connection between the gut microbiome and pain up until now. And the other thing that they did in this study was they looked at mice with inflammatory bowel disease. And what they did was, in some of these mice, they blocked the pain receptor, they blocked the pain signaling. And in other mice, they allowed the pain signaling to continue. So essentially, they were simulating what would happen if we were taking painkillers and we had inflammatory bowel disease. And in the ones that had their pain signals blocked, their mucus layer got much thinner and the levels of inflammation in the gut went higher. So their inflammatory bowel condition actually worsened and they developed a disbalance in the gut microbiome. So they developed more of the harmful microorganisms within the gut microbiome in comparison to the beneficial ones. So in actual fact, it didn't just have an impact on the mucus layer, it had an impact on the severity of the inflammatory bowel disease as well. This obviously may have consequences for us, although it's a mouse study, you know, in people who have inflammatory bowel disease who quite often get pain, then, you know, if they're continually taking painkillers, for example, that might be another reason why we see more inflammation in the gut and more problems with increased permeability of the gut wall as well in these conditions. So it may be that taking painkillers regularly does contribute to that. Also, migraine painkillers, some special MAB migraine painkillers are anti-CGRP. So that's the neuropeptide that connects the pain receptors with the goblet cells and communicates between the two. And so you're knocking out this pathway with certain migraine drugs as well, and that may have an impact on the thickness of the mucosal layer. So that's important. Interestingly, in that same study, they gave the mice capsaicin as well, which is chili peppers. And in the mice that were given chili peppers, they actually had thicker mucus layer in their gut. So it appears that chili peppers are actually pretty good at sort of stimulating these nociceptors in our gut and in enhancing the thickness of our mucus layer. So that's quite an interesting study.
It's showing incredibly the link interesting
between the gut microbiome and these painful stimuli. So I think we ought to be considering whether we use painkillers and how, you know, how widely we use them, and whether we're harming our gut if we do.
Yeah, certainly one of those papers that might really, you know, add to the changing the way that we think about managing pain. And it is interesting. So the three things you've mentioned are in these mice who are unable, they removed the pain receptors, so they didn't feel pain. So if they didn't have these receptors, they didn't produce this protective mucus, which meant that their gut barrier, they got more dysbiosis, which is an imbalance in their gut microbiota, and they had an increased susceptibility to colitis. So you can see that, you know, not detecting pain had huge consequences for their health. So that is very, very interesting. And I think the I haven't read the paper in detail like you, but I did read a brief comment by one of the researchers, which I thought was quite interesting, because obviously this is only a mouse study. It's not a human study. But he did say that it makes you think the actionable points are that, you know, maybe what we could take from it are how important gut health is in the pain signaling process, and to encourage, you know, promoting gut health really and looking after your gut microbiota, which I thought was interesting, because it's actually sort of saying what we're sort of trying to say, which is you can get started on improving your gut health and improving your gut microbiota composition straight away with these lifestyle medicine modalities without waiting for the research, because you know that it's going to be a good thing for your health and physiology. But I thought that was, you know, really interesting paper.
Yeah. And also I wrote a little blog for BSLM. So it's on their website at the moment, if you're interested in getting the link for that paper, and we'll reference it at the end of this podcast as well. It's one to have a wee look at. So we're about ready to wrap things up, Shiv.
We're running out of time. So what I suggest we do, obviously we're finding our way in this podcast world, but I thought we'd just wrap things up and let's just summarize some of the things we've mentioned in the podcast. So let's say, I don't know, four things each. So I would say, number one, you are 50% microbial by cell count, but over 99% microbial by gene count. Number two, you inherit your gut microbiota at birth, mainly from your mother's birth canal, plus the importance of breastfeeding to collect more microbes and the HMOs, these human milk oligosaccharides that feed the good gut microbes in the baby's gut. Number three, most of your microbes are bacteria and they're in your colon. And finally, number four, the gut microbiome is key to all aspects of your physiology and health. That's my four. What about you, Sheena?
Cool. That sounds good. Yeah, I suppose I could add to that by saying that your gut microbiota is unique to you. So it's much like a fingerprint. You're not going to find anybody else with exactly the same microbiota as you. And it is largely determined by, you know, your lifestyle, what you do. So really familiarize yourself with the pillars of lifestyle medicine, because these are vital to the health of your gut microbiome. What else? Well, the gut barrier, so the wall of the gut microbiome, of the gut and the mucus layer are really, really important to the health of the gut microbiome, and therefore important to our health. So that's something to take great care of and beware of having too many painkillers, as we've discussed. And what else can I say? Well, be aware of people who, you know, may have had some damage to their gut microbiome, or, you know, have missed vital steps in the development of their gut microbiome. So people that are born by C-section, have had, you know, formula feeding, have had long periods of stress in their life, you know, have had poor diets. These individuals may be really lacking good health in their gut microbiome. And that's like an important thing to identify, because that is something that we can manipulate and change. So be aware of that. And that's really what we should be focusing on. So what's in the next podcast, Shiv?
So next time, there's so many good things to talk about, but next time we thought we'd focus on fermented food and its relationship to the gut microbiome. So we will be discussing the evidence about it, and so you can start brewing your kombucha now and get that sauerkraut recipe out, Gina.
Fabulous. That sounds really, really good. If you have enjoyed this podcast and if you want to learn a little bit more, please look up the Gut Microbiome for Clinicians, which is the course that Siobhan and I have co-written. It's on the BSLM website, bslm.org.uk, and it's available as an online course that is in 10 easy-to-use modules, so really easy to do. Okay, if you have any questions that you would like us to answer, then please contact BSLM and let them know, and we'll try and put in a few listener questions in every podcast that we do. Thanks so much for listening. I really hope you've heard something amazing today, something different, and something that you can take forward in your studies. Siobhan, anything else to add before we finish up?
No, I just want everyone to remember that they're 50% microbial.
Lovely. All right. Thank you so much for listening today. My name's Dr. Sheena Fraser.
And I'm Dr. Siobhan McCormack, and we are Microbiome Medics.